Welcome to the Faith is Not Blind podcast. I'm Bruce Hafen, and tonight we're talking with Leo Weiniger here in Bountiful. Leo, thank you for coming to join us tonight.
Thank you, Bruce.
Glad to get acquainted with you. You have a very interesting story to share with us, and it, in some ways, is like what we have come to call a story of return. And that's the shorthand way of introducing what you're going to tell us about. I'm eager to kind of jump right into that. Maybe we should start with the early part of your life, particularly focusing on your upbringing, the development of your faith. What do you remember about the early years in your life and the development of your testimony?
Yeah, a pretty standard story, especially for someone in Utah, I would say. Pretty typical. So went through all of the youth development, young men. I was a deacon, teacher, priest. I went on a mission. I was one of the first to go out of my friends, and so I kind of felt some pressure to go. But I did read some of the Book of Mormon before I left and felt like I'd received some kind of spiritual experience with the Book of Mormon, so that felt good. My mission was incredible. I remember feeling the Spirit daily in abundance on my mission. Also, when I was endowed, before I went on my mission, I had a good experience. And when I was endowed, the washing and anointing especially was a very, very spiritual moment for me. So, pretty normal growing up in the church.
Sounds like you developed a pretty good foundation. Mm-hmm. I'm eager to find out what happened as time went on with that foundation. It sounds like it kept growing. You felt the Spirit on the mission. Can you remember an example?
I remember the first time I taught from was the charlas in Spanish, but the discussion books, and I was helping my trainer to teach on the first vision, and I knew what I was saying, what it represented. I was still trying to learn the language, but I remember sharing that message the first time, and it was raining. It was a beautiful, like a picturesque moment, this elderly gentleman, and I was trying to convey it in the most loving way I could, with the most compassion and most feeling I could. And I remember him looking at me, and his eyes looked like they were watering up, like he was feeling something. And I felt something, you know. And then I turned to my companion, I said, "Me entiende," which means, does he understand what I'm saying? Because my Spanish felt so broken. But that was the first time. But all the rest of the times when I testified of Joseph Smith on the mission, I felt the Spirit strongly, and some amazing experiences as well after that. With
so it sounds like that developed your own testimony of Joseph Smith.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I had a strong testimony of Joseph.
Telling that story recalls what happened to him, and you see other people catch on, and then you catch on, and it adds to your own faith. Go on. What happened after that?
Served a faithful mission the full 2 years, and went through kind of a life-changing experience where I broke my foot. Wasn't a smart move, but it was probably for the best because I was going to the U, and sorry to all the BYU or all to the U fans out there, but I was going to the U, and then I dropped out of the U and went to BYU. I felt like I needed to go to BYU, and I had some really good experiences there. Religion classes there were very helpful for me. At the time when I was going to BYU in the early 2000s, there wasn't a lot of church history open discussion, and so that will tie into my faith crisis. But up until that point, when I was in my early 20s, I really didn't know much about church history, and I take responsibility for myself for not knowing much. But I also now have a more balanced view of I could have probably received more instruction on some of the difficult issues in church history.
Yeah, but do you think that's fairly typical of the experience others were having, that they don't know a lot about church history by the time they get to that point? Mm-hmm. It's not really required in the church curriculum or even BYU, except maybe Doctrine and Covenants. So that's an interesting tip. We may want to come back to that.
Yeah.
Because knowing more about church history, you can point us toward later, but is it good or not so good to know a lot about church history?
It is so good to know as much about church history as you can, as early as you can.
As early as you can. Yes. Yeah, that's important. We will come back to that.
Yes.
Okay. Keep going now. You were married. You met your wife at BYU.
Yes. Yep. It was a classic meeting. We met in some apartments there where we both lived, and I was her home teacher actually for a time, so that kind of helped. And but yeah, we fell in love. Pretty typical experience. And then we got married, and then had our first kid, our first baby, our son, our oldest son, and that was about 10 years ago. He just turned 10. So that's when the shelf crashed.
The shelf crashed. Talk specifically about that. What do you mean the shelf crashed?
So I didn't know much about plural marriage. And the first video I remember, I mean, I watched a lot of videos and read a lot of stuff on the internet at the time. But the first video I saw, which was in 2011, was a video of the Manti pageant with all of Joseph Smith's wives lined up. And they were evangelical Christians that had come to protest the church. But the women had, each came representing a different plural wife. And they had a little sign on their chest, and they were talking to people and saying, my name is, whoever it was, and they would explain their experience.
And why were they at the Manti pageant?
They were trying to protest the church by using that part of history.
Okay,
to
so
shock,
this,
to shock
this was,
people.
Okay, they were kind of mocking the idea of plural marriage by imitating it in that way.
Yeah, I think they see it probably not necessarily as mocking, from their perspective. I see why we would say mocking, but for their perspective, they're trying to teach the truth, right? They're trying to share the truth and help to open the eyes of
get
members.
Get people thinking about it, yeah. And did that get you thinking about it?
Oh, yeah.
Why, in what way was that new for you?
It was new information. Yeah, I didn't really ever come across that. And again, it's partially my responsibility to have studied that. I thought church history was boring. And that's when my curiosity took over.
Yeah.
To see that, like, is this true?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I hadn't been curious enough before to be much of a self-starter in your...
No.
And you're searching of...
I was a lazy learner.
Yeah. So keep talking then.
Yeah. So that's what happened. That's kind of the other term that we use in this faith journey lingo is going down the rabbit hole. And that kind of sent me down in my journey down the rabbit hole and started researching other critical information. And one of the key points for me in my what's called a deconstruction phase, where I'm starting to deconstruct my belief system, was that I'd lost trust in the institution. I was blaming the institution for not teaching me these things.
Oh, so you blamed them for the fact that you didn't know about it.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. I thought, this is such important information. Why wasn't I taught this from an early age?
Yeah. Yeah. So did you conclude somehow that the church had not been talking about polygamy ever, or did you just miss it?
Yeah, I mean I'm a pretty fair person when it comes to who has responsibility. I hold myself responsible, personal responsibility, but I do think we could do a better job in the church, in families, and I know that we're doing a good job in seminaries, institutes now,
yeah,
with our younger kids, and a lot of bishops are reading the Gospel Topics essays now. And we didn't really have an open dialogue about it. Was the correlated material that we offered in the church.
Yeah.
Then our critics call it whitewashing, right, of church history, and or hiding the truth. And I'm not going to say that's what we did, but because I don't believe that, but I do believe that we could have done a little bit better job in being more open and discussing these things, maybe even in young men's lessons or something. Mm. Could have had a teacher that would have said, there's some issues that we could probably wrestle with together as a quorum or something.
And let me ask you a question about that, Leo, because I'm thinking of my own experience during the time you talked about. So this was, what year was it when you had the experience at the pageant?
I was watching a video on YouTube, and it was in 2011.
Okay.
Yeah.
In the early 90s, BYU joined with the Macmillan Company, an internationally known publisher of encyclopedias, to publish the Encyclopedia of Mormonism.
Yes.
And it has a pretty thorough treatment of plural marriage. Mm-hmm. And so when I have heard people say the church didn't, it's as if they didn't want anybody to know about it, they had hidden it.
Right.
But I guess I'm just wondering why I had heard so much about it and you hadn't. I think that tells us something we need to know, that it's not, what made you feel that you had been deceived?
Yeah, you know, I'm a skeptical person naturally. I've always been very skeptical. I'm more optimistic and probably I would say less cynical now than I have been in my past, but I was pretty cynical at the time. And you kind of don't want to, when you're going through a faith crisis and deconstructing, you don't want to blame yourself.
Yeah.
It's heavy.
Yeah.
And there's large communities of former members now where there is no taking self-responsibility. There is not a lot of that. I'll be honest. I listen to a lot of people in these communities, and there isn't a lot of personal responsibility. For I could have learned this more. It's all about blaming the church.
Okay.
And so that's kind of the spirit that you gain, the spirit of blaming, of accusation.
And that's
where I was at.
And down the rabbit hole, did that attitude grow as you learned more?
Yeah. Yeah. I was a quiet doubter. I was a closet doubter, you could say, and a closet atheist. I just didn't.
Atheist, did you say?
Yeah.
So how did you get from wondering about Joseph Smith and the church to becoming an atheist? What was it like to be an atheist? You know, we assume that means you didn't believe in God at all. Is that where you were?
Yeah.
How did you get from the issues about the church to feeling that you were an atheist?
Well, our connection with God in this church, in our church, is so much through the church, right? The prophet guides us to God. Uh-huh. And we're so good at teaching against other false doctrines and other churches, other religions, that when you deconstruct that belief system in the church, the one true church, what else, you know, would there be? And so my foundation in Christ was questioned. My spiritual experiences were questioned. I didn't have a strong, what I call personal epistemic framework. My personal epistemology now is much broader. I see God in a lot of other ways than I did before. Before it was mostly just warm, peaceful feelings, which some people would call elevation emotion.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of there. I thought, you know, those spiritual experiences could just be, you know, in my mind.
Yeah. As I listen to you talk, your experience describes what I have heard and read about a lot of other people. It's very similar, and that's why I find it so helpful, mm-hmm. that it was because you assumed that if you were feeling this way, the church was responsible, not you. And that's understandable and believable.
Yeah.
And you kept going. And then what kind of knocks the wind out of people, as it does me just hearing it, is that people can move so quickly from doubting about the church to doubting about God. And ironically, it's because they have believed the church was the pathway to God. And mm-hmm. if the church isn't what I thought it was, then there's no pathway, there's no God. That's pretty significant.
The one true church, no longer true. What else is true? So you kind of start from ground zero in a way, you know?
Okay,
your five senses, right? You can rely on your own experience. What do I sense? What do I see? What do I feel? But your spiritual sense is kind of knocked to zero when you go through a faith crisis.
What was the effect of your spiritual sense being knocked to zero if you had thought back to your mission when you felt the Spirit, as you said? You felt it frequently, you knew what it was. When you started doubting all these things, mm-hmm. how would you have explained what was happening on your mission?
Yeah, so the elevation emotion is what I think psychologists would call it.
Talk about that.
So it's just an elevation, it's a feeling of heightened awareness, of, you know, warm fuzzies. A lot of the, you know, biological or physiological response that we'd have to the Spirit.
Did you consciously think about that explanation for the earlier experiences you'd had?
Yeah, that's what I think most, even those that go to evangelical Christianity from our church, they teach in other churches that the spirit is not a good discerner of truth, right? It's more of the Bible, right? So even people that turn to Christianity, yeah. they don't believe that the spirit can, you can, you know, go to God and ask, you know, a binary question, is this church true? They don't think that's a reliable way to find truth.
Is that?
Because we can be deceived.
Yeah, that's because what we call the spirit can be seen as, and sometimes is, emotion, right?
Yeah, yeah. So it's hard to discern between emotion and so when you get in that state where you're questioning, like it's hard to know if the spirit is really the spirit or...
Yeah.
So that's why bigger miracles sometimes are needed, and that's what I experienced.
Okay, bigger miracles are needed.
Epistemology is like, is it more than just a spiritual, like a warm, fuzzy feeling? Is it something that's bigger that's like, I can't explain that?
Yeah. I think you told me earlier that you had majored in psychology, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that may have given you a framework for seeing things in this way, and yet...
Self-analysis.
I think your story is very instructive to other people who are wondering what is going on here. Mm-hmm. How long were you in the rabbit hole? How long did your deconstruction take? And what else did it look like?
Yeah, so it was a couple of years from that first video. It was a slow process, slow deconstruction, because I still was trying to play the game. We talked about this before, but physically in, mentally out.
So what's the acronym?
It's PIMO. P-I-M-O.
Physically in, mentally out.
Mentally out.
Of the church.
Of the
church. So you continue to attend church.
Yeah. And I think we have a lot of people in the church, and I'm speaking to people now. If you're watching this and you're like that, I understand what it's like. It's a difficult place. You've experienced cognitive dissonance where you're living, you're paying tithing, you're maybe serving in a calling, and you're not connected with everything else. You don't believe in the truth claims of the church at the time. And that's a very heavy burden.
Heavy. What did that burden feel like? I just would like to hear your description.
Lonely, dark, scary.
So you were in this, the rest of your family weren't in this with you. You were just there yourself, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty lonely.
I tried at one point, because you don't want to hurt people. I tried at one point to reach out to my stake president, and that didn't go very well, unfortunately.
What could he have, how could he have responded that would have been more helpful?
I hear you.
Okay. That you would have felt more fully listened to.
Yeah. Mm. It was more of a bear of a testimony. You'd pat me on the bum and send me out the door. Get with the program.
Yeah. Mm. Okay, that's important. So what happened to pull you out of this, Leo? Something did, and we need to know what it is and what it was like.
I needed someone with deep historical knowledge to help me. And so I one day had a thought to reach out to someone that was more professionally trained in history, that was a faithful person. And the thought came out of nowhere. And I call it my spiritual defibrillator. It shocked me.
Yeah.
I was like, whoa, what was that? And because I was kind of dead inside, spiritually dead inside at the time.
What approach did he take with you, in contrast to what happened with your stake president?
I needed someone that would listen and acknowledge the facts that I was struggling with, the facts of history, especially around plural marriage. I really struggled with that. And I needed that person, whoever it was, I needed someone to say, I hear why, I don't understand why this is difficult.
Yeah.
And I've wrestled with this. And I would encourage you. And so this person I reached out to was a miraculous experience that I had. Like I said, the Spirit spoke to me out of the blue. And I reached out to this person and it was, and we could, anybody could, that's having a faith crisis could work one-on-one with someone like this. There's professors at BYU, for example, who have open door. And they an open email. You reach out to any of them, and they'll drop at a drop of a hat. They'll minister to you.
Yeah. So what were you doing, trusting a BYU professor? You'd kind of lost trust in the institution of the church and in God.
Yeah.
And yet you went to see a BYU professor.
Yeah. They're that's a different sense that you get from someone who's spent a lifetime studying and is trained to study and understands history and is what seems to be an honest and kind person. And the person that I worked with at BYU was all of the, checked all the boxes.
How did you know that? Had you had him as a teacher before?
Yes.
So,
yes.
Okay, you were going to
someone that I had appreciated before in college.
But
I hadn't thought about that person for years, and that's why it was such a miraculous experience. Out of the blue, I heard those words.
Okay, that was the significant part of the miracle, is that you heard those words. And what was that?
It was contact this person. It said, the Spirit told me exactly who to contact.
And how did you get that impression?
That's what the miracle is. I wasn't thinking about the person. It was out of the blue. It was like a lightning strike. I was saying to people that it was an audible voice because I was dead inside spiritually. It wasn't a spiritual voice. It was like an audible voice. I heard a voice that was said,
go see him.
Go contact this person. Yeah. And I didn't deserve it. Just an act of grace.
You were ready to see him even before he started talking, is that right?
I trusted him. I liked him from my class. I knew he was smart.
Okay.
I knew he was a good
person.
It's
so important for leaders, for teachers, for parents. You trusted him.
Yeah, because he was so intelligent. And I thought, if someone knows about this stuff and is able to stay in the church, how can you do that? And the term that people use that criticize the church is called mental gymnastics. And I was curious to know, is this person able to perform at the highest, Olympic level gymnastics and work in a job, teach the gospel?
Yeah.
Is so honest and so sincere, but so brilliant in church history. How can this person manage that? And so that was part of my curiosity.
How many
times
did you talk to him? Was it over a period
of time? We talked over a period of time, but it was through email. My first email really set me on my path. It was, the message was, I hear you, which is what I needed.
Yeah.
I love you. And that was also good. But he said, in his email, he said, these are some of the facts, and I acknowledge those, and we can acknowledge those, that's true. He said, why don't you try to, and it sounds like you're starting to assign new assumptions, you're making new assumptions about these facts. You're assuming new things about these facts. And he actually outlined some of my new assumptions that he thought, that it sounded like I was making about, Joseph Smith.
So the problem was not so much about history per se, but about the expectations or assumptions you had made?
The meaning we place upon the facts of history. Because any fact of history can be interpreted 1,000 different ways, you know?
Yeah, talk more about that. I think it's a really important point.
It's really important. Yeah, it's super important because you can look at any historical figure and the facts can say, for one person, something, very, very, damning, or something that's actually kind
depending
of
depending on the assumptions that they bring to it, right?
Right, and their knowledge of history. How does history work?
Yeah.
What's the cultural context? There's a thinking error called presentism that people struggle with in the church, and there's a lot of great videos on that. Or articles about present. So I was presenting my current cultural sensitivities onto Joseph. And how could Joseph have done this? And I just was not ready, prepared mentally through study of history, of general history either, to be able to handle
that. It sounds to me like what happened to you was not just about history. It was more fundamental. It was how do you look at history and why? And can you say any more about what caused you to shift your paradigm about the assumptions you'd been making?
It was like a flip of a switch, to be honest, Bruce. It was like just that invitation. It was just like, why don't you just try to assume differently?
Did he say this to you, or did
he invited me to try to assume a little bit more positive feelings about Joseph, and continue to study. He invited me to, which was awesome. Like, don't just stop studying. He didn't say stop looking at anti-Mormon literature.
Right.
He actually said keep studying. And and he encouraged me to involve God. And that invitation was also a huge thing for me because I had really stopped praying with my heart and mind.
That's really significant. It's not just history, It's about assumptions and expectations, being willing to reconsider, and then reconnecting with God. Mm-hmm. And as those things began to and your own recognition of the prompting that had come to you, kind of a direct message, mm-hmm. and then that added up to something, I guess. What did it add up to?
It was taking more personal responsibility and involving God in my learning process. Trying to involve, because I loved God before, yeah. And I just was more of, I don't know if God is there, but I remember my first, one of my key moments in my journey was my first prayer that I had was alone in my room. Hmm. My wife wasn't there, and I remember I was yelling out loud at the ceiling, totally irreverent, and I just yelled at God. I was so angry.
Back when you were having your crisis?
Yeah, when I was coming out of it.
Oh, when you were coming out
yeah.
of it?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
I had a lot of anger toward, I didn't want to be angry at myself, right? That's the whole thing, is you can't be angry with yourself when you feel like a victim. So you have to be angry at something, and God absorbed my anger. I yelled at him. I said, why did you have Joseph do this? If you're a real God, why did you have Joseph do this?
So,
and he listened to me, and he absorbed my anger, and he returned it with peace and answers and love. It was a miracle.
And did that come to you in your relationship with him? I mean, it was, he gave you peace and love in exchange for the anger you were feeling.
Yeah.
And that, what did that do to you? I think what you're describing is a new discovery about faith.
Yeah. He just wants to hear from us.
Yeah.
You know, and not be lukewarm, right? I was hot. I was so hot. I was so angry. And I just needed to, you know, he wanted to hear from me. And I told him, I said, this is why I'm angry. And I need answers. And I gave him an ultimatum. I said, I need answers. And I need it right away because I'm really mad about
this.
Did
he answer on your terms or his?
He started answering pretty quickly after that because I started taking some of Steve's recommendations or this person I was trying to work with that I'd been working with, my minister, I'd say.
Yeah.
And I was taking some of these recommendations to study some of the material from church scholars. And their perspective started to soften my heart.
Yeah.
And it really helped me to see things in a new light. So
you've returned to church activity. You're not just physically in, you're mentally in. Mm-hmm. And your heart is in it, it sounds like.
Yeah. And it's been quite a wrestle, though. I mean, I feel like once you've gone through something like this, the dark night of the soul, it's almost like you still feel lonely. It's hard to belong at church sometimes. Still.
That's not unusual, and I'm glad that you would be candid about that. Mm-hmm. As people are having these experiences, it's helpful to know that that can be. It's a process.
It is
but
a process.
I'd be interested in sort of linking back to the way you talked before. Before you went on your mission, you grew up. I am a Mormon boy, and mm-hmm. How is your faith different now from the way it was then? What has the rabbit hole done for you when you sort of found your way back in the way that you've described?
My faith is definitely different. I'll be honest. It's deeper, it's broader, wider, and it's a little more nuanced. I see things. When I reconstructed my belief system, I received a lot of answers that dealt with who prophets really are. How does revelation really work?
Yes, yes.
And the way I see the church now, I believe it's God's true church, but I also like the living part where the restoration continues.
Yes.
And there's a lot of things that I see now that I didn't see before.
How is your relationship with God different now from the way it was before?
I spent a lot of time interacting with evangelical Christians in my reconstruction process. Part of my time spent over the last 10 years has been kind of debating people about church history issues because I want to defend the church. But I've learned a lot from these good people, our Christian friends, about grace. And grace is probably the biggest thing that's really helped me is to know that God, this life is a gift of grace. The earth's a gift of grace. I see Christ's atonement as a gift of grace as well. And all these things that are unmerited favor for me personally, and that God loves me even though I've been through this, even though I feel alone sometimes in the church. I feel like I'm still loved and wanted.
And you didn't really know that
because of grace
before. Yeah, there's a sense in which the what you went through opened up a new perspective on the church, on history, your relationship with God. It had both intellectual and spiritual components.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was not just an emotional thing. It was reinforced mm-hmm. By what you discovered about history and the way you looked at it. Mm-hmm. It's a really great story, Leo. What would you say to people who are still in that rabbit hole?
I mean, I want to look them in the eyes and tell them, I love you. I love you.
Yeah. And you
sorry.
Can, that's why you can understand them.
I love you guys. I love you. And there's people that understand and that want to help and minister to you. And I'll be the first one to raise my hand and say, I want to talk to you and love you and work through the concerns that you have together. If no one else you have, no one else that you can trust, I will be one person. And I'll point you to others maybe that you want to talk to that might be helpful
yeah.
too. Other church scholars. So I work with a lot of church scholars and help people if I can now.
Yeah, your story is in some ways a rediscovery of trust in God, the church, mm-hmm. church scholars. That was all linked. And you, what you've told us is a way to get the links back into connection with each other and
yeah.
with you.
Trust is interesting
yeah.
now. Yeah, trust is important. When you first hear something new that's turns out to be true from a source that is new, and the prior source that you thought that should have told you didn't tell you, your trust can shift immediately.
Yeah.
And that's what happens. And so you have to be able to reshift your...
Yeah, you can shift it back. That's what you've told us beautifully, mm-hmm. Leo. Thank you so much for
thank
that.
You.
Thank you for sharing your experience so candidly.
You're welcome.
It will be very helpful to a lot of people.
I hope so.
Thank you.